Hello, welcome to the Music Show on RN. I'm Andrew Ford. Do you know what a Tonmeister is? Well, we're listening to the work of Tonmeister Virginia Reed. Virginia Reed is an engineer and a producer, and she is responsible for having made this particular recording of the Second Brandenburg Concerto of Bach. In fact, we've played lots of her recordings over the years on the Music Show. She works for ABC Classics, and she is the first woman to win an ARIA Award for Engineer of the Year. That was in 2013. She was also, that year, the first classical producer to win the award, and she's up for another one. On Wednesday, she is a finalist in the Australian Women in Music Awards for studio production. But we wondered, what does a Tonmeister do exactly? It's a whole range of things, and so we thought we'd ask. Well, we had to wait for that last little bit of reverb. That was the last movement of the Second Brandenburg Concerto of Bach, and we heard Hans-Dieter Mickartz playing recorder, Will Roth playing trumpet, Anna MacDonald violin, Anthony Chesterman on oboe, and the Orchestra of the Antipodes, directed by Anthony Walker. It was recorded 16 years ago on this very spot by the person standing next to me, who's Virginia Reed. Virginia, welcome to the Music Show.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Now that we don't have those players around us, or it's just you and me, tell us about this space, because as our listeners can hear, it comes with a certain amount of reverberation, natural reverberation, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very large space. Not quite sure exactly what the dimensions are, but it does fit a full orchestra in here. It is actually particularly beautiful acoustic for Baroque music, I have found over the years. I've recorded everything from a solo piano, solo voice, to very large scale orchestras. And I find the Baroque music is just the right size group to work beautifully in the acoustic of Goossens Hall. So it's a lovely high ceiling, nice wooden floor. It's beautiful and warm.
And you put the lights on early so that they stop creaking by the time you work.
Absolutely, yes. That's one of the things that I will do, is make sure that all the lights are shining in the right direction and not going to get in people's eyes and not make noise.
When I record interviews in here, which isn't very often, normally I try and do it quite close to one of the walls so that we don't get as much reverb. But presumably when you're in here with the Orchestra of the Antipodes, for example, you put them bang in the middle?
Not so much bang in the middle, because the floor does work a little bit like a drum, and in the middle of the room it gets a bit too boomy and a bit too difficult to... It gets all mushy. So I do go sort of fairly close to the back wall of the hall and use that as a sort of a sounding board to propel the sound out into the larger part of the space. And that's sort of where my microphones will be to capture the musicians.
And of course, knowing where to put the microphones is a lot of the job. Do you normally work with just a pair, a stereo pair?
Well, that's the methods that I use are quite like that. Yeah, essentially, yes. I like the minimal mic technique. I find that a stereo pair of omnidirectional microphones will work in many, many circumstances. And even for a full orchestra, if you get that stereo pair in the right position, you will get pretty well exactly what you want in terms of the sound, and then you'll use extra microphones just to bring some instruments a little bit further forward. They might sound very far away, and so you'll bring them a little bit closer and a little bit more into focus.
And when it comes to a group like, say, the one we've just heard, which is maybe, I don't know, 10 players altogether, including those four soloists, you would have the microphones reasonably close to them? I mean, how high do you go? Because you stick them up on a pole, don't you?
Yeah. For that recording, I had them quite high. And I also positioned the musicians in such a way so that they were all quite evenly spaced around the microphone, so that it wouldn't be very how they would set up for a concert, but it's good for them to all see and hear each other, and they're also all well positioned to all naturally balance themselves in the microphones rather than me having to do lots of mixing and up and down and everything. They know that if they alter their balance, that will be reflected in what's heard on the recording.
Maybe we should go and sit down in the place where you do the mixing after you've recorded with your microphones in this space here in the Eugene Goossens Hall, and we could talk a little bit more about what you do. But while we walk, maybe we should listen to another track from that was recorded also here. This is Nicole Carr.
Yes, that was a lovely recording. That was with the Australian Opera and Ballet Orchestra and Nicole Carr, and she was standing pretty well right where we are now, right, facing out that way into the orchestra. So she was standing in the middle of the orchestra. They were all sort of around her, and she was facing the conductor.
When we listen to this recording, what we see in our mind's eye, I suppose, is the singer pointing towards us and the orchestra behind her. But that's actually not what you recorded.
No, so she was sort of, again, in a position where a lot of her sound was getting into the main stereo pair. Like, I did have about another 15 or 16 microphones out there, and I had some special particular microphones just for her, but yes, that works well.
Nicole Carr was the soprano with the Australian Opera and Ballet Orchestra, conducted by Andrea Molino, and that was a little of Chilea's opera, Adriana Lecouvreur, Io son l'umile ancella, I am the humble servant, recorded by my guest on today's music show, the Tonmeister, Virginia Reed. We better talk about this word, Tonmeister. It embraces a lot of skills, doesn't it?
It has quite a variety of meanings, but essentially from a practical perspective, it means someone who can deal with all the technical issues of setting up the microphones and making sure everything's in the right place and getting your sound recorded and, you know, all the technical side of things. But it also implies that you know the repertoire and can read the music and can also listen to what's being recorded and give feedback to the musicians about what they need to do in the next take to do it even better, and then involves doing the editing and the mixing and So it's sort of two hats you're wearing.
Yeah. Sounds like 12 to me.
Well, again, yeah.
And you forgot psychologist.
Well, yes, absolutely. Being a good psychologist is also half the battle in getting a really good recording made.
Is that because performers are nervous or what? What do you have to? Where does the psychology come in, Virginia?
Certainly, yes, nerves is one thing, but it's also a recording is a very artificial process, really. Music is performing and you generally need an audience, and the audience creates a bit of an adrenaline and creates something special for the performers to work with, whereas just in a recording, there's none of that feedback from the audience, so I have to be the audience and give the kind of encouragement that an audience would be doing. And sometimes you have to remind the musicians that, you know, this is a performance. You've just recorded a take that was all very correct, and yes, your music teacher from when you were a child would probably be very happy, but was it really a great musical performance? You've got to know how to ask those questions in a way that is going to have a positive effect.
Do you have to know when to cut your losses as well?
Very much so, yes. And certainly I feel that every recording has a bit of an arc to it, that people start, there will be something fresh and exciting in their performance, but there might be a few technical issues, and then it will improve. You'll have a few more takes where it's getting better and better and more relaxed and more musical, but then you will reach a point where a bit of fatigue will set in or a sort of kind of boredom. It's like the spontaneity has gone, and you can hear when you've reached that point, and hopefully by that point you've got everything that you need to edit together a really good performance, and then you sort of, yes, move on.
I assume that also there must be recordings where you have in your mind what you want and the performer has a different idea. I mean, that would obviously happen in a rehearsal room, you know, with a conductor or a director in opera as well. But is this something else that you have to pussyfoot around?
Especially with conductors, they will have very strong opinions of what they want, and you do need to acknowledge that. And there are times where I say, no, well, technically this needs to be better or whatever. But then there are times where it's like I will ask, well, could you make this crescendo a bit louder, or could you in this writ get a little bit slower? Or you will quickly get to know what a conductor, what they're thinking and what their style is. And sometimes you might ask something that they will absolutely disagree with, and they'll go, nope, nope, I won't do that. And you'll go, okay, sure, fine. But other times they will go, oh, okay, yes, yes, you're right, I will try that. And that's when it becomes really enjoyable, when the conductor realizes that you're working with them and we're working towards creating a really wonderful performance, not just a document of this piece of music.
And once you've got the thing in the can, many, many takes of certain bits, and you retreat into your little cupboard where you work and do the editing, a whole different set of skills?
I think so. Well, certainly my ability as an editor helps me with my work as a producer at the recording session. So I will know what I can achieve with editing, and so then I will know I can tell a musician, relax, that's okay. That one note that's really hard to pitch or very long or whatever, I know we've got that. You can forget about worrying about that. We might need to get the things around it. I will have the confidence to tell a musician at a recording session, you have that, we can move on, or you don't have that, we really need to do it again. So then once I then go in and start editing, it's a lovely creative process. You're sort of building again sort of the ultimate performance of that particular musician or that group. And everything that you promised and were striving for in the recording session, you make real at that point. Yes, it's all more computery stuff, but essentially it's all about the music.
And are you one of these people who thinks that a long take is a good take, or do you think that that's irrelevant, that you can build a good performance almost note by note if necessary, and it'll still be convincing?
That's a very good question, because you can answer yes and no to that. Often the way I approach, I will get the musicians to play a long stretch of the music to sort of get the big picture in their head and get a sense of the large shape. We might do that one or two times, and then we might sort of home in on a few little awkward places and work on those, do a couple of short takes that just deal with a particular section. And then once we've done all of that, we might then go, okay, you can relax now, you've got it all, but why don't you do one more take, a long complete take, and see if that, with the pressure off, see what it yields. Sometimes a take like that might give you just one or two notes that you'll end up editing in, but they might be so fabulous and so musical and spontaneous that they're the difference between making an ordinary recording to listen to or something that really is exciting to listen to and something that you'll want to return to over and over.
But always after something that sounds like a performance.
Yeah, I can make musicians sound absolutely perfect and correct. I can take, you know, yes, you could piece together a recording from very many, very short little takes, and you might listen to it and go, there's nothing wrong with that, but it might not move you in any way. But when you've recorded a musician who really knows the repertoire well and is performing it beautifully, if you've done it in lots of little sections or in a couple of big long takes, you will hear that it's a wonderful performance regardless.
And do you sometimes, or do you ever opt for a take or a phrase or a note which is not perfect because it's more musical?
Oh, yes. For me, the musicality, the performance, the drama is pretty well the supreme characteristic that you're going for. And sometimes, yes, I will try and work in something that was just so wonderfully heartfelt performed, and it might be a little bit sharper, it might be, the attack might have been a bit not quite so clean, but in the context of the whole piece, it might be so moving and wonderful that, yeah, I will try and put things like that in. And there are times where the musicians will love it and they'll go, oh, yeah, you know, they won't notice that it was there. And other musicians will go, oh, I'm flat there, or take it out, you know. So sometimes, and you always have to, you know, if a musician doesn't like it, you'll do it. You'll fix it for them.
We're sitting here with these enormous speakers, and I've been in here with you when you've been working, and you hear things so beautifully, and you can put on your headphones and you've got this absolute state-of-the-art sound. I'm terribly aware that here we are in 2019 and people seem to be not listening to CDs anymore but kind of preferring MP3s, which sound horrible. Why? Well, I don't know whether you can explain the psychology behind why people would rather listen to bad audio, but how does it affect your job?
Certainly, it affects my job enormously. The industry is changing very rapidly. Even the sort of young people I work with who do all the social media are finding it hard to keep up. Certainly, it is an interesting phenomenon that people are wanting to have music on the go, and they'd rather have lots and lots of music accessible at all times rather than a smaller amount of music that they can listen to with greater quality, I guess. I think there is a lot of pleasure to be had from listening to really good reproduction of a recording. That is a wonderful thing, and I think people listen to that less and less, which is also why I think the interesting phenomena of vinyl is coming back so much, which I have a very hard time to understand, because vinyl had a lot of problems. And especially, I would say, for classical music, digital audio was wonderful for classical music, that suddenly you could have reproduce much more accurately the full dynamic range and the full frequency range. So digital has been great.
There are people, of course, who argue the opposite.
I know.
And I'm going to be forwarding their emails to you.
Yes, exactly. Yes, thank you. I know I'm opening a can of worms because it's a very emotional issue. But certainly the idea of a sort of having a long form album that is a collection of a few pieces where thought has gone into what pieces are we going to put together, what's the order of them, how do they flow together, this idea of a larger experience that is going to take you more than a few minutes to appreciate, and it might require sitting down and listening to it, is a way of life that we don't really have at the moment. I don't know what to think about it. I'm disturbed by it, but I keep plugging away, and hopefully I think that people will return to these things because it is so enlivening and good for your brain and good for your soul, and to listen to well-performed music that sounds great. You can't beat it.
There isn't a sign on the door that says Virginia Reed Tonmeister, but there might as well be. I mean, this is your domain here.
This is my home, yes.
So when you have to leave it and fly to Perth and record in concert Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde, is that a completely different kettle of fish?
Certainly, I'm very at home here. I know every nuance of this particular studio, and I've made many albums in here. But yeah, going to another venue is also very, very exciting. I still enjoy the challenge. It's exhausting and it's hard work, and it's an interesting battle to set up for a recording like Tristan and Isolde, where it's a live performance. So there are lots of things that you can't do because you don't want to get in the way of the show, but you also want to capture it as well as you possibly can, because then at the end of it, they're all going to want to hear that show repeated. I've learned how to sort of take the things that I need from a technical perspective to make that work.
And when it's such a big piece, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the forces mm-hmm. involved, in terms of the noise it makes, and in terms of the space, yeah. I mean, Perth Concert Hall is a wonderful hall, yes. but nevertheless, it's not this hall. It's not the one you're used mm-hmm. to. Do you find you're doing a lot more work afterwards?
Not necessarily afterwards, apart from the fact that Tristan and Isolde is massively long and a lot of forces involved. All the work is in the preparation, really. It really is. We spent a couple of days setting up and making sure that all the microphones we needed were in the right place and they were doing the right job. And it was good because I had recorded an album with them not sort of less than a year earlier with Stuart Skelton. And so that was the one where I had to prove myself to Wazzo. And I think I did that. So then when I came back, it was a lot easier. And the whole concert hall they were on board. We were doing hanging microphones from all sorts of crazy places and wanting to put microphones on stage that in other circumstances, people might have said, oh, you can't possibly put that there, no. But everyone was very accommodating, and it took a lot to set up. But then at the end of it everything was there that I needed to edit and mix it together.
Well, we'll listen to a little bit of the fruits of your labour, but good luck on Wednesday.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a lot of fun.
Gunn-Britt Barkmin singing Isolde's Liebestod, the love death from the end of Tristan and Isolde. And that was with the West Australian Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Asher Fish, and the recording engineered and produced by Virginia Reed.